What's up, world? I'm Matt Newberg from Hungry, and this is The Feed. Each episode, we'll dive into conversations with the industry insiders who are leveraging technology to shape the way we eat. On today's episode of The Feed, the Hungry Trends community sat down with Dan Folkman, SVP of Business at GoPuff, the market leader in delivery of instant needs. Since its start on college campuses in 2013, GoPuff has evolved from selling vape cartridges to a selection of over 4,000 unique items ranging from prepared food to liquor, produce, and beauty products. And it's just getting started. In this episode, we'll dive into what sets GoPuff apart from newer 15-minute delivery players, its new advertising business, the capital expenditures it has invested into its network over the last 8 years, and much more. So I'm very, very excited to be joined today by Dan Folkman. He's the Senior Vice President of Business at GoPuff, the market leader in the delivery of instant needs with a network of nearly 600 micro-fulfillment centers that cover 30% of the U.S. and now U.K. and France. In his leadership role, Dan oversees GoPuff's global business development, corporate development, marketing, and communications efforts. Prior to GoPuff, he founded a number of startups and held entrepreneurial roles in college real estate, consumer insights, location-based social networking, and sports-focused companies. Dan, welcome aboard.
Matt, thanks for having me.
I really want to go back in time. I was an undergraduate at the University of Pennsylvania, kind of right around the time I think you were at Drexel. I'm very curious to kind of get your take on the GoPuff founding story of, you know, kind of the initial set of selection that you guys offered, how you guys were delivering it via car, I think, and how you got into this tier two city expansion from there and how your customer has kind of evolved from that point.
Absolutely. And just, you know, small clarification, I actually went to Syracuse. Our two founders went to Drexel. I'm Philly proud though, born and raised, but I got to give a shout out to the Orange. But yeah, let me tell you a little bit about the story, our founding story, and I can tell you kind of how the business has evolved from there, which is, you know, some of the foundational components, like you mentioned, of scaling through college markets in tier two cities before going to large metros. But going back almost 9 years, you know, Raphael and Yakir, as you mentioned, were students at Drexel. They met freshman year, and it really is a quintessential startup story. They became best friends, and today they're probably closer friends than they've ever been, which is really cool to see. You know, they moved into a house with a couple other buddies sophomore year, and Yakir was the only one who had a car. And so basically, you can imagine his sophomore year was spent driving, you know, his roommates and friends around to get snacks, to get convenience store items, to get groceries. And, you know, 9 years ago, there was no real solution to get convenience store items delivered. And so the idea for GoPuff actually came from the fact that Raf and Yakir were trying to solve their own use case, right? They wanted to get convenience store items. They didn't want to pay premiums, and they wanted to be delivered quickly and efficiently. And so, you know, when they look to actually solve this problem, you're talking about 2013, where you've got a lot of progress in rideshare with Uber and Lyft, and they're really transforming the way that people, they get from place point A to point B. You have, in food delivery, you have companies like Seamless and Grubhub, and all of these third-party services were in their very early days. And at the time, a lot of folks out in Silicon Valley and in tech in general were pushing this concept of, you know, build asset light marketplaces that connect, you know, one side of the marketplace to the other. Going back to Raf and Yakir's upbringing, they're both first generation Americans. Yakir's family's from Israel. Raf's family's from Russia. Yakir grew up in his family's business, in the jewelry business in Philadelphia, and Raf in banquet halls and restaurants, you know, running their family businesses and learning how to build something from scratch. And, you know, a couple of the things that they learned, that I've learned from them, that, you know, have we even tried to instill in the company over the last eight, 9 years, is this idea of A, controlling the entire customer experience, right, end to end. B, building a business that actually produces cash and is sustainable long term. Because as you can imagine, in family business, you know, there is no venture capital, there's no PE firm, there's no lifeline financially, right? You have to build a business that funds itself. And then C, and seems obvious, but really isn't, is the value of hard work and building something that's operationally complex and kind of, you know, managing it from top to bottom. And so when those guys started GoPuff, they did it a different way. They took this contrarian approach. Instead of building an asset-light marketplace, they got a fulfillment center in West Philadelphia. They bought all their inventory from BJ's, and they did the first 10,000 deliveries or so themselves, right? Really nitty-gritty Philly upbringing, you know, and the business caught on like wildfire. right? They were at Drexel. Students like you at Penn picked up on the service at Temple. And over the first 3 or 4 years, the business actually was cash flow positive. We didn't take on any venture capital. And we used the cash from the markets that we were operating in to open new markets and fund the early growth of the business. And so, you know, they were doing everything from selling furniture online. You know, they made, I think we joke, the first venture was office furniture ventures that put $50,000 in, right? Because it was the guys selling, you know, used furniture online to fund the business. But really what it took to kind of get the business off the ground. Now, you mentioned the approach that we took once it started. You know, this business started in cities, high dense cities that had a number of colleges. So Philadelphia is a great example, Boston, Washington, D.C., Austin, Texas. And over the first handful of years after that, we were launching in college markets and tier 2 and tier 3 cities, to your point, right? One, it was because when the business started, it was college students starting a business for college kids, which has dramatically evolved over time. But two, it was because you could understand the density of a tight delivery zone best in a college market. And then as you expand to bigger cities, you can replicate what you did in one delivery zone to 10, 15, 20 delivery zones in one city that cover an entire city. So now, when you look at the evolution of the business, we're not only, we've operated and been very successful in those cities, but now we're operating in the biggest cities in the world, in New York, in London, in LA, in Chicago, and our demographic has evolved pretty tremendously, right? So going from what was a service for college kids, now our core demo is 25 to 35. And honestly, we're seeing some of the fastest growth in our 35 and older demographic, specifically parents, right? We've gone from the 100 SKUs to over 4,000 SKUs, which now include baby products, pet, beauty, over-the-counter medicine, things like that. We're actually selling fresh food and coffee. You and I have talked about that, Matt. And really evolving the use case of the platform to go from this, like, I need something quick to I'm getting everything that I need on GoPuff when I actually need it.
Very cool. So it's safe to say you've kind of evolved from that initial, like the customers have grown up with you and are loyal, but now there's this new cohort of people who are much older, who never even tapped into this in college, who are now, you know, in those cities because you have that density of those micro fulfillment centers in those cities, that it's kind of evolved to a new audience and taken on a new customer base.
Absolutely.
Last time we spoke, you mentioned that GoPuff is building the rails for modern commerce. I really want to unpack that statement and what that means from kind of a front end and a back end perspective. And I guess starting kind of with this idea of like content and commerce, right? How is GoPuff enabling this platform that allows for a new form of content, whether it's celebrity brands or, you know, hyper local brands, to kind of transact in this kind of on-demand economy?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think, you know, when we think about the foundational components of our business, that's what we refer to as the rails for the future of commerce. You know, it's the combination of the 600 plus buildings and the infrastructure that we've built, the liquor licenses that we've acquired. We have over 400 liquor licenses in the U.S., which are highly complex and, you know, and regulated at the county level. So, you know, the tedious approach that has to go into actually procuring these is a competitive advantage. And then the technology that powers everything, right, that powers the entire system. And when Raf and Yekir started this business, and as we built this business, there was no off-the-shelf tech solution that would power this idea of instant commerce, because when they started this business, you know, the biggest innovation at that time was two-hour delivery or same-day delivery, right? 20 years ago, 20-plus years ago, Amazon, you know, revolutionized shopping with two-day ship. That evolved to one-day ship, to two-hour delivery. And now where behavior is going is consumers want these things in an instant, in the same way they don't want to wait for a taxi cab, or when they're booking hotel, or when they're traveling, they use Airbnb, or, you know, Spotify and Netflix, like democratizing access to movies and music. We believe that what we've created is a platform that gives consumers the accessibility to the products that they want and need at their fingertips. And to be able to get it in the instant, this is transforming the behavior of these consumers. And so I say all that to say, with that foundation that's been 8 or 9 years of investment, I mean, we've raised over $3.5 billion in capital, but we've deployed a lot of it. And rather than deploying it in the way that a lot of others do in terms of subsidizing acquisition costs, we've invested it in this infrastructure to power this type of commerce. What you now start to run through those rails, that's where we have a lot of fun, right? Because it went from this convenience concept, which was, you know, a $250 billion industry, to this concept of instant needs, which is in the trillions in terms of market opportunity. And that goes to the coffee and the pizza and the kitchens business that you and I have talked about. It goes to our private label business that we just launched with our Basically line. And it goes to these local and celebrity brands that you referenced. And so one of the things that we focus on is how do we make sure that the partnership or the markets that we operate in, we are speaking to the communities in which we operate, right? And so we have thousands of local brands across the platform. You know, Philly has its own flavor, Chicago has its own flavor, even London has its own flavor. And you want to make sure that people in those cities feel that GoPuff is part of that community. And then you go to celebrity brands. I mean, we just recently were the exclusive instant delivery partner for Mr. Beast's Feastable. It's these chocolate bars. They're delicious, you know, and we dropped it on our platform. It was the only place you could get it delivered instantly. And Selena Gomez is a partner, and she's an investor in Serendipity Ice Cream. And so, you know, launching that or growing that brand on our platform. So we've really become this platform where whether it's a celebrity, an influencer, or a local business, they're coming to us and realizing that GoPuff is the right vehicle to get their goods on into this demographic, into this generation, but make it super accessible, not just in one market, but on a global scale. And we believe that long term, the success of our platform is predicated on the differentiation in the assortment that we carry and the uniqueness or the exclusivity around the goods that are available on our platform.
Fascinating that, you know, talking about Mr. Beast, like, I feel like the same analogy with like Mr. Beast Burger and, you know, these host kitchens of like, you know, essentially a network of diners and cafes that are cooking his burger. You guys have created the first party rails to enable that on the CPG side, because like historically there's really been no kind of infrastructure on the CPG side to tap into that growing demand for convenience.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think it's very well articulated. First of all, I think this concept of vertical integration is rooted in everything that we do, right? And you look at, for example, our ads platform that we've been able to build on top of the core business. That's all because of the first party approach. And so not only are we able to help these brands get closer to consumers, because of the data that we have access to, because of the influence we have on consumers, in the sense of these are the highest intent shoppers that you're gonna see on in commerce, in our opinion, and the bottom of the funnel moment in which CPGs are able to advertise to consumers, it creates this unparalleled opportunity to advertise, right, to customers, and it's important to us that what we do on the ad side of the business is accretive for the customer experience as well. This is not just a let's run ads and hope customers like it. This is a highly curated approach to make sure that the ads that consumers are seeing are highly relevant and applicable to how they shop and how we believe they want to shop based on the patterns that we understand in their behavior and other consumers' behaviors. And so our CPG partners love it. And it's not, by the way, it's not just the large brands. I mean, yes, Unilever and PepsiCo and these brands are huge partners, but also the local brands and these celebrity brands that are able to advertise. And we're able to kind of give them access to this platform that we've been building. And so it's early days for the ad platform, but we're seeing really encouraging results in the form of, you know, over 3-to-1 returns for our CPG brands in terms of ad dollars. And, you know, just under 50% of consumers that are actually seeing an ad are converting, you know, which is unprecedented in the space. And again, it's early days, but it's something we're incredibly bullish on. And it all goes back to this idea of first party and vertically integrated approach that we've taken. That's what enables all of this.
Wow. Yeah. Being kind of like at the bottom of that kind of funnel is super interesting and unique to GoPuff, of applying that kind of instant needs lens. Can you also talk about a little bit of the sampling opportunity within those CPG brands? Like, you know, essentially trialing new products very quickly in a kind of single use manner, and then like reordering those products after they see an ad, or kind of that opportunity for brands to like essentially mimic the Costco-like experience of trying a brand?
Yeah, I mean, look, so when you take a step back, if you think about product sampling, you know, in its nascent stages, or not, I should say in its physical state, it's a highly ineffective method of marketing, because you have no ability to track who is receiving the products. You don't know who they are going into giving those products, right? I remember being in college and you'd like walk down the street and someone's handing you like a Muscle Milk and they have no idea who you are. They have no idea where you came from. Did you just have lunch? Are you going to lunch? Do you even want to have that Muscle Milk? I was a fan of Muscle Milk, but it's nothing against the brand. It's more of the methodology. And you know, then you look at how do you digitize an offering like that and leverage this first party platform that we've developed. And so we're able in real time to target consumers based on who they are, where they are, what they buy, what they don't buy, what we believe their interests to be, to make sure that the products that end up in their bags are curated to them, right? And it's valuable because customers love free products, but they love them more when they're specific to who they are. Brands love it because they know who they're sampling to, and then they know that they can learn about how customers perform and why they actually repurchase, so that when we develop other campaigns, they're much more specific to the right types of customers. Because I think one of the challenges with advertising for CPG specifically is the inability to track true performance in a way that a lot of other digitally native companies can. And I think that what we've been able to build and what we're building unlocks that capability for these CPG brands. And what I believe long term that equates to is, you know, you're talking about savings or in terms of efficiency of dollar spend for CPG advertisers in the hundreds of millions to billions over time, right? Because if you know more about the consumers that you're targeting, then you're going to spend those dollars a lot smarter. But if the majority of those dollars are being spent to just blanket and get products in hands or get people to see the brand, you have no understanding of the efficiency of the dollars that you're spending. So you've got over $200 billion in ad dollars being spent by CPGs in the US alone annually. It's escalating at like 13 to 15% year over year. Think about how inefficient some of those dollars are being spent today. Imagine a world where those dollars are all trackable and being spent in a really, really targeted way. The return that these brands are going to be seeing long term, it's going to be tenfold.
Yeah, I think it's a win-win. Like, if you can get me on the consumer side, Instagram-like algorithm of like targeted advertising that I can actually taste, right? And then on the brand side, you know, that same level of precision. It's a much more efficient kind of marketplace, so to speak. Very cool, and I think that's something that really differentiates you from traditional retail. Obviously, you know, retailers currently rely on shelf space and slotting fees to just get to like the very small net margins that they have. Looking at some of the leaked numbers from Axios, I know you can't comment on them, but you know, GoPuff's margins at the warehouse level are about 2 times the best in class grocers. And that's not even looking at the advertising business. There's been a lot said about the quick commerce kind of business model lately that I feel like is misunderstood. We have the recent interview with Ralph Wenzel from Joker, who was trying to break down the kind of contribution margins on his business, and the numbers really didn't add up to me. I really wanted to spend some time talking about the difference between unit level economics and warehouse level economics and kind of how that all rolls up to the corporate level, because the general sentiment in this business, in this space, is that everybody is burning cash and not seeing any returns. But, you know, that's obviously, you guys have been in the game for about 8 years. We know that, you know, for the more mature warehouses, that's definitely not the case. So I'm curious if you can kind of help us look at the line items of what goes into kind of the contribution margins at the, you know, unit level side and the four-wall EBITDA margins of the warehouses, how that all kind of equates.
Well, look, I think that the most important thing to think about is we've been doing this for over 8 years, right? And we're doing it at scale. And there is only one GoPuff. And, you know, I think when we think about our business, you're looking at, you know, a network that is at a level of scale that not any other platform has. You're looking at technology that powers the end-to-end experience from receiving product to, and how we buy product, to customers actually consuming that product. It's proprietary and unparalleled technology that powers the whole thing. And I say all that to say that scale, technology, infrastructure, and capital investment are required to make instant delivery work long term. The model is that we built is inherently sustainable at its foundations, right? You buy inventory and you sell it for more than you buy it. Now, if you sell a dollar for 99 cents, you're starting on the wrong foot, right? And so you have to start with product margin. That's where the business starts. Our products are competitively priced, right? It's important to us that we provide consumers with an unparalleled combination of variety, availability, affordability, and speed. And we make our money on the products that we sell in our ads business, right? Not on the couriers who deliver them or the service fees. You know, when you think about the variable cost to the business, you're talking about the cost of goods and you're talking about labor costs, right? Folks inside the fulfillment center who are picking and packing orders and delivery partners who are delivering those orders. The reason I started with scale is because it's important that this business will only work with real scale and with efficient processes and technology to power it. If you do everything manually and you don't have scale, you can understand there's a world where people are going to burn a ton of cash. For us, we've invested in that infrastructure at the onset. Remember, we didn't take on capital for the first 3 years of the business. The business was cash flow positive, right? We focused on nailing the business model before actually scaling it, where I think you're seeing a lot of examples of companies that took the opposite approach, which is go after scale before figuring out the business model. That's not a recipe for success, right? And so when you look at our business, we've made acquisitions like RideOS, which is one of the best on-the-road logistics tech companies in the world. Justin Ho and his partner Chris started this company 4 or 5 years ago, focused on how do you make delivery more efficient through technology. How do you build systems that get smarter with data and with patterns and with experience to over time enhance the experience both for the delivery partner and the consumer while getting benefit to the customer. And so that was an acquisition we did last year. And we've seen a massive benefit in integrating that team and integrating their technology. And now they're building more solutions for us. And remember, like, part of scale that's important is, you know, we have more lessons learned through mistakes over the last 8 or 9 years than many companies have made decisions. And we're able to leverage a lot of that to continue to get smarter in how we operate. And so being able to prove that at the unit level, right, or at the order level, you can make money. At the unit level, being the MFC level, you can make money. And then at the metro level, as you scale, you can make money. That's a really important component to being able to invest and have the conviction to invest aggressively to scale the business, right? And then to my point earlier, you start to see compounding velocity gain with scale. And we've always thought about our business as this global business that thinks very locally, because you design networks in every market that are optimized for that market specifically or that city specifically to facilitate fast and reliable delivery. Because let's not be fooled, speed is only as good as it is consistent. To have a model that facilitates a platform for delivery partners where they can make money, and then to have a model where the business can actually make money at scale, because if the business isn't sustainable, it won't work.
Totally. When we get into some of these newer players that you were referencing, who are really hung up on this 10, 15 minute idea versus you guys that are kind of targeting, you know, more of a 30 minute or less service level agreement, what does the customer ultimately want and what is more important? To me, that is something that is a customer acquisition trick that doesn't leverage, you know, optimal driver drops per hour or what, you know, the number of deliveries a driver can do per hour. Because if you increase your times to some extent, you can batch more efficiently. So how do you guys think about this? And why has this become kind of the buzzword of today?
Well, I think it's become the buzzword of today because if you take GoPuff out of the picture and you look at anyone else's advertising and you remove the color and the logo, it's all the same, right? Which is 10-minute groceries delivered in 10 minutes. And to your point, it's a great tagline to catch people's attention and get people to try a service. But I believe what I said, which is speed is only as good as it is consistent, right? And consistency and reliability are how we've built this brand over the last 8 to 9 years. And we're seeing the benefit of that reliability, that customer trust that we've built as we're launching markets like New York and London and you know, other markets in Europe, you know, because for a long time, we were the only player in the space you know, cities like New York, and I'm sure you're reading a lot of things about a lot of these cities, but cities like New York and London and Paris are some of the most competitive spaces in instant delivery, albeit the nascent stage of the category. You know, our moat, our infrastructure, our scale, our brand have created a dynamic where when we enter these markets, they've now become our fastest growing cities in our entire portfolio, right? We never scaled for the sake of scaling. We figured out the business model, we built the infrastructure, and then we invested in the growth. And so that's really where the benefit is. And so when we look at the customer value prop, which is really all that matters, because at the end of the day, the customer is our boss. You're talking about the most variety in one basket. You're talking about speed with consistency, affordability and flat delivery fees, and you know, an affordable pricing model for consumers, competitive and affordable. And you're talking about availability. Our service is open later and longer than any other service. And so getting all of that together in one service or one platform, that's where we win. And we've seen that from where how our organic growth continues to build, how we enter these new markets. And that's why we took so much time thinking about what the model needed to look like and how do we optimize this to be sustainable and long-term, because, you know, we didn't set out to build GoPuff, or Raf and Yakir didn't set out, and we haven't joined, a lot of people haven't joined, for this to be a flash in the pan business or category. Like, we believe the future of commerce is instant, and we believe that GoPuff is going to be a generational business that shapes that behavior no differently than Airbnb, no differently than Uber, Spotify, Netflix, and these other companies that have transformed the way that consumers behave.
It's clear that GoPuff is the leader when it comes to first party. But then there's also, if you look at just delivery as a whole, we've been talking about the difference between owned and operated first party and third party, which is DoorDash convenience, which has about double the share of GoPuff. If we look at, you know, some of the latest data from Yipit that recently came out, can you help people understand the trade-offs there between getting the actual margin from, you know, the products that you sell, and when it comes to, like, obtaining these liquor licenses, right? If you look at Uber's acquisition of Drizly, how that compares to GoPuff. I think there's a lot of confusion around that, and then also, like, what that unlocks as far as attachment from other kind of adjacent categories.
Yeah, so there's a lot to unpack there. So let's take it step by step, right? Let's start with the fact that first party delivery, our model, and third party delivery are fundamentally different. And we think it's comparing apples to oranges, and quite frankly believe that, you know, looking at market share data across two fundamentally different models is the wrong way to do it, you know, for lack of a better way of saying it. So you referenced the Yipit report that came out this week. It shows that GoPuff has over 70% category share in first party delivery in the US. That's the category share that should be referenced. That's what we believe is matters, because we don't look at third party delivery as competitive. It's a completely different model. And further, when we think about third party delivery, we don't believe it's sustainable, which is why we built this vertically integrated model. And I think you're seeing that in seeing a lot of third party players start to explore other models to drive profitability long term. And so when you look at our business at its core, it works. The fundamentals are sound. Right? And when that's the case, you can build a lot on top of that. When you look at third party, you have a lot of companies who have built great businesses, by the way. These are huge businesses that are servicing millions of customers, you know, and I think it's great to be able to provide methodologies for consumers to get the things that they want. But when they're not sustainable at their core, you're forced to find other ways to drive profitability and long-term sustainability for the business, which is just not the case in first party. The reference to liquor licenses, I mean, again, this speaks to the vertically integrated approach versus the marketplace approach, right? For GoPuff, we own the liquor licenses. We control the customer experience. You know, we make our money on the product margin. Our business isn't based on take rates and fees. It's based on product margin. And so that's the approach that we've always felt was the right way to do it. It's best for the consumer because you have full control of the experience, inventory visibility, you know, control over the customer promise. You control what's going on in those four walls. And it's good for the delivery partner because they're able to make more money than these third-party services. They're able to have a better experience. There's less wear and tear on the car, you know, more predictability in their work days. And then for GoPuff or the company, it's more beneficial because you have an ability to actually produce cash on a per order basis at scale. And so I think that's really the important piece here. And I agree, there is this misconception that, you know, I think the two big misconceptions in the space right now are how operationally complex this business is and how challenging it actually is to operate. And you're starting to see that with folks who are trying to figure it out unsuccessfully. And then the long-term path to sustainability and that the upfront investment in infrastructure and technology actually puts us in position to be sustainable long-term. It's not, you know, the misnomer of this is high cost, low margin. That's just, it's just plain wrong.
Kind of pulling on that thread more and looking at, like, you know, the you've acquired a lot of some liquor chains and you've also acquired, you know, companies overseas that are, you know, operating in the UK and France that are doing kind of a similar quick commerce model. How do you think about scaling the infrastructure through M&A versus like organic growth in Europe and in the US? And then I'm also curious after we get into that to talk kind of about like the key differences in those consumers and the market. But we're going to start by talking about kind of the infrastructure and scale there.
Absolutely. I mean, look, again, an important thing to note is for the first 7 years of our business, all of our growth was organic, right? There was no M&A activity for the first 7 years. You know, when we look at growth, the three things that we focus on are geographic expansion, category expansion, like what we sell, and then our technology and people. And M&A serves as a really strategic tool to materially pull forward one of those items, right? And so if we can find a partner that enables us to accelerate our roadmap in one of those pillars, then we think it makes sense. Pending that we like the team, like the founders, believe, see the world the same way, like that stuff is really important. The cultural components are really important. You know, BevMo was an example of strategic growth from a geographic perspective, right? We weren't operating in the state of California at the time. BevMo has 161 stores on the West Coast, 143 of which are in California. All of them have liquor licenses, which is a complex regulatory state when it comes to alcohol. You know, you're talking about 60% unaided awareness. You're talking about millions of loyalty customers and a brand that people love. In California, which from a GDP perspective is like the same size as the UK. And so the acquisition of BevMo allowed us to accelerate our entry into California, which probably would have taken 4 or 5 years, honestly, to build the right infrastructure the way we'd want to. And we did it in less than 12 months, the majority of the integration. So we're still completing that integration, but over 100 BevMos now have the ability to deliver GoPuff and BevMo, which is an incredible experience for customers without sacrificing any of the experience that they came to know and love with BevMo. We did the same thing with Liquor Barn in Kentucky. You know, you look at Liquor Barn, 90% of people who live in Louisville, Lexington, and Northern Kentucky are within a mile of a Liquor Barn. So that proximity to consumers, similar to the 60% of people who live in California that are within a mile, mile and a half of a BevMo. So you think about that strategic real estate footprint you acquire, the liquor licenses that you acquire. Liquor Barn specifically has an incredible assortment, probably the best assortment in terms of whiskey, bourbon, scotch that we're able to then scale to our entire network. So now you're talking about picking up geographic expansion and category expansion. You look at the deals that we did in Europe with Deja and Fancy. They were in their early stages, but they had great management teams. They had a ton of localized knowledge in regions that we had never operated in. You know, we acquired over 40 buildings across, you know, the UK, across France, and across Spain. And it gave us, and 300 great employees, 300 plus great employees. So overnight, we had a business in Europe. And we've been able to use that acquisition as the launch pad and then bring those two companies with GoPuff and bring all three together to create our European business, which has been on an absolute tear since launching it about 3 months ago.
Well, yeah, I was reading the information article and looking at some of the Yipit data that showed that you're about 40% market share in the UK, which is insane considering how quickly that happened. I guess, can you also talk a little bit more to like what a consumer overseas expects is looking for from a service like GoPuff, kind of what those baskets look like versus over here in the US and your kind of core market?
It's a great question and something that, you know, we're really excited about learning because, you know, I think our initial thought going into Europe was that given the 8 years of experience in the US, that it was going to be a one-way street. We were going to teach the European business so much about how to operate this category. And we've been pleasantly surprised in how much we've learned from the European market. One, we have an incredible team, you know, and they're executing, as you mentioned, very well. But two, the consumer is very different, to your point. And so things like produce and high quality products are the most important to consumers in Europe. And an example actually is a grocery business in Europe is a key component to that business. That was something we weren't operating in the US. And we've learned a ton about operating grocery and produce and you know, categories like that in Europe, and are now bringing that over to the US as well. Because we've learned so much about what it does to consumer behavior. You know, so I think that's a notable difference. I think the local expertise is key in these markets because, you know, the types of brands, the types of use cases, the local brands, all of that stuff differs, you know, when you go overseas. And so making sure that consumers are getting the GoPuff experience that they want in London, in Paris, versus the GoPuff experience that New Yorkers want is key. There are some, I mentioned earlier, this idea of operating globally, but thinking locally, like that is applicable across the business. And that's something we've really tried to maintain. And we benefit from having a great European team and a great US-based team that can work together to figure out what is that optimal experience.
I really love how you're talking about learning from Europe about grocery and perishables, because, you know, GoPuff's like kind of bread and butter up until kind of recently was really around these kind of longer shelf stable items. Can you talk about, you know, kind of how you layer on these other categories of different margin profiles, whether it's, you know, food service through GoPuff kitchens, produce, like you mentioned, beauty products and private label, how that kind of constructs the basket and that kind of order size and the margin profile there, and what the impact is to the infrastructure you've built. I mean, clearly building an macro distribution network that works for getting Trident gum into your micro fulfillment centers is not going to be the same for getting, you know, a fresh loaf of bread or some lettuce from a local farm. How will that all impact your network?
Yeah, I mean, when you think about it, first of all, our assortment selection is predicated on consumer demand, right? So understanding what customers want is core at what we carry, core to what we carry, excuse me. There's the question you mentioned at the end around, you know, how do you operate a supply chain that can facilitate these different types of SKUs? I mean, one, we're very fortunate to have an incredible team with, you know, decades and probably over 100 years of experience in this space, and that can be nimble and can adjust based on what the categories are and what how we need to procure those goods to make sure we have them for consumers. And you're right, that varies based on categories like ice cream or alcohol or fresh food or, you know, baked bread or that loaf of bread, to your point. But I think when you think about it in terms of how do you layer these things on, one of the core components, and this is why we refer to this as like the rails for the future of commerce, is the actual cost to deliver a pint of ice cream or a pie of pizza or a bottle of wine, it's the same. Right? You're putting an item in a bag in the hands of a delivery partner and bringing it to the consumer. You drive efficiency on that cost based on volume and, you know, binning, batching, and routing effectively. But when you think about adding new categories, all you're doing is you're doing two things. One, you're adding use cases or reasons for a consumer to come to the platform. And two, you're widening a basket. Right? You're increasing the ticket size. And that's what we've seen from a lot of these categories is material increases in ticket size and frequency. But what they do for cross-category pollinization, I think that's the most valuable thing, right? And so one of my favorite stats is 90% of consumers that are actually buying a kitchen item or a fresh food item are buying a non-kitchen item, at least one with it. So you have this cross-category pollinization right out of the gate, which makes consumers stickier and more valuable long-term. And then from a how do you drive demand long-term, you have customers who are realizing, I can go to GoPuff to get cleaning supplies, I can go to get pizza, I can go to get a bottle of wine, I can get diapers. Maybe I want all of those things at the same time, maybe I want them in separate orders. But it's their choice as to what they get and when they get it, but they know that GoPuff has all of those things and is consistent and reliable in how we get there. Now, when you think about private label, which we introduced a few weeks ago, I mean, the majority of those decisions are informed by customer demand. Everything from what types of products we carry to what types of packaging to the sizing of the SKUs that we introduced. One of the examples is like, you know, our basics line around snacks is, you know, we found that consumers love the mix of flavors. And so rather than just having standard trail mix or standard, you know, some of these other snacks, we've created these funky flavors that are not really seen on other platforms. So creating a fun and cool brand that consumers can only get on our platform, but having things like habanero barbecue in terms of like the, you know, the snack lines, this is stuff that's unique to GoPuff and it's driven by the demand of our consumers.
I really like what you were saying about kind of adding in all these different categories and that the fact that the delivery cost is fixed because you're essentially leveraging your infrastructure and deleveraging some of those fixed costs to essentially do something that would be very difficult or cost prohibitive to do alone, like a ghost kitchen that requires a lot of demand, as we've, is something I've covered a lot and excited to see kind of how that evolves. I want to get into some of the audience Q&A. The first question we have is kind of around the Uber Eats partnership. How successful has it been? Has this driven new customers and downloads to the standard GoPuff app? How, you know, talk a little bit about how that's going.
Yeah, well, first, I mean, Uber is a great partner. You know, we very much have enjoyed working with them. And I think it was an example that it was a partnership that I think a lot of people in the industry were surprised by, because historically everyone had considered all of us competitors. Whereas I've mentioned, we don't look at third party as competition. And I think that, you know, there was clear value in the partnership for Uber in the sense that they're not operating micro fulfillment centers. They're not a first party model, but they want to be able to bring this, you know, unique assortment of like immediate and everyday needs to consumers fast and efficiently. So the idea of white labeling the GoPuff service as everyday essentials, you know, on Uber Eats, which is powered by GoPuff, was kind of a first of its kind partnership, and validates, I think, as you can imagine, what we've built and the way that we've built it. For GoPuff, there's clear value in the reach that Uber Eats has as the largest global food delivery platform and the awareness that it brings around our brand. And it's a different type of consumer. You know, what they're buying and how they're buying it is slightly different. And so we're learning a lot. Uber Eats is learning a lot. We consider this has been a super successful partnership so far. And, you know, we'll kind of see what transpires from there. But that's kind of the update on Uber Eats.
Very interesting. So the average household, according to this reader, says the average household spends about $700 a month on food at home, which is $8,000 a year. What percentage of that does GoPuff target to capture?
I think it's important to think about how we actually look at consumer behavior. Some of the ways that consumers shop are changing in terms of, you know, maybe they would go to this store or that store and now they're using GoPuff. A lot of the other things that GoPuff provides are around the white spaces or examples of shopping that didn't exist before, right? And so we're not in direct competition with grocers. That's not really how we think about it. I mean, there are definitely overlaps in use cases, but we provide the ability for consumers to get exactly what they want whenever they want it. And a lot of those use cases didn't exist before. So being able to get diapers and you know, a meal at 2 a.m. when everything else is closed, those were just dollars not being spent. So I think I'm saying all that to say that I think this unmatched variety and accessibility that the platform provides has created, you know, expansion in wallet, right? So consumers are just going to be spending more because these are new behaviors and use cases that they can actually fulfill through our platform. It's not to say that there's not overlap with other these categories, but I just think it would be minimizing the impact of the platform that we've built and the way that consumers use it to focus purely on, you know, a metric like that.
Very interesting. And I think that really like ties in really well into this kind of argument that's been going around, you know, bodegas versus quick commerce and, you know, various delivery companies that are VC backed, and this kind of narrative that like it's a zero sum game. I think that's a really nice way to kind of frame it. We have another question kind of around, you know, how you guys are supporting minority brands and building those kinds of opportunities for those kind of entrepreneurs on your platform.
Yeah, this is actually one of the initiatives that I'm most proud of that our teams brought to life, you know, since I've been at the company, which is 6 years. We launched a program called Put Me On earlier last year in partnership with Chris Paul, who's been a fantastic partner. And the whole concept there was to create a business incubator for founders and from underrepresented backgrounds in the CPG space specifically. So to get their products onto the platform to give them access to our teams and our expertise and our resources to grow, and then to kind of graduate them out of that incubator into that next phase of growth. And so we actually completed our first cohort a couple months ago, and have already selected our second cohort, which launches in the next few months. And the program's been incredibly exciting. Our founders and our partner, our brands, have loved the first iteration. I mean, it's going to continue to evolve over time, but we feel like this is a program that has legs to grow and scale, and being able to give these up and coming brands access to distribution and ad opportunities and support the needs that they have day in and day out. I think that's what GoPuff can give back to these types of brands and these types of communities in a way that's unique to our platform.
Has there been an example of a brand that you guys have helped scale beyond that kind of local market that entrepreneur is in? And is that kind of a potential like kind of opportunity for that specific brand that you help incubate?
Yeah, we've done that with a number of brands. And I think that, you know, the first cohort of the Put Me On program just ended. So there's a lot of growth that's now going to come for these brands. But that's the objective with a lot of our brands, is how do we take them from one city to multiple cities, assuming that that's what they want and that's the thing for their business. And that's the platform that we've created, because it's very easy for us to go from Philly to national, whereas a lot of other, you know, other retailers or other companies don't have the ability to do it that quickly. To your point, we have this first party platform that helps CPG specifically.
On the note of other companies, we got James asking, what do you see as the end state for individual markets? I think there's 7, 8, 9 plus instant delivery services in New York, with Joker looking to offload infrastructure and 1520 is already folding. How many instant commerce providers is sustainable in a given market?
I would say this. We believe instant commerce is a winner takes most. And we believe that GoPuff is, you know, well positioned to be the winner. You know, we're the category leader in the US. As you mentioned, we're very close to becoming the category leader in the UK and France, and we've been there for not that long. And I think you're gonna see pretty rapid consolidation over the next 12 to 24 months. Either consolidation or companies going out of business, because the approaches that are being taken are unsustainable. I think investors are seeing that. You're seeing, you know, companies kind of either go under or get acquired. I mean, you've seen 4 or 5 companies in the last 6 months where this has happened. Investor sentiment is changing, you know, and that's not just because of the current market dynamic. It's because they're realizing that, like, the capital required to compete in the space is material, and the infrastructure that we've built. I mean, GoPuff is operating in a league of its own. We fundamentally believe that. And we say that with all the humility in the world, by the way. And so I'm not saying that there won't be competition. I'm not saying there won't be other players, but you're not going to have a world where you have 8 options in every city. It's just not sustainable.
I always reference this one chart from a very good blog called Sakura, which talks about this kind of capital cycle of instant commerce and how that kind of is analogous to what happened with e-scooter sharing, like Bird and Lime and all those companies, which is we start with optimism. The VC funding accelerates prospect of high returns. That leads to competition, more entrants enter, returns fall below the cost of capital. That leads to pessimism as companies consolidate, funding decelerates. That's where we are now. And then there's a recovery. A contraction on the supply side leads to rising returns. Would you say that's accurate?
I think that's incredibly well articulated. And look, realize the big difference between this category and maybe rideshare or scooters or even food delivery is we've been doing this for 8 or 9 years. And the majority of that time, we were very under the radar. By design, we didn't do media. We didn't talk about what we were doing. I think people have been incredibly surprised at how much scale we've achieved in such a short period of time. Whereas a lot of these other categories, you know, the media hype started right out of the gate. So we smile when we see all of the competition coming into the space, because one, it's validation of the model that we built in the category that we've created. But two, we've been paying attention to instant commerce for 8 or 9 years. Everyone's now paying attention to it in the last 6 months. And I think that alone is a symbolism of how far ahead GoPuff actually is right now.
Awesome. Well, it's been really fascinating to chat with you, Dan. Kind of coming up at the end of our conversation, I'm curious, either you could share or just something you've seen out there from a customer, like what is the most interesting GoPuff order or what is your go-to GoPuff order?
I'm going to go with go-to because I don't want to, you know, share anyone else's GoPuff orders. I am a huge fan of our cauliflower crust pizza. So big shout out to our GoPuff Kitchens team. I get the pizza way too often. It's actually, the one I get is the sausage, you know, cauliflower crust pizza. And then I have to go with, you know, the team as a joke made a milkshake with my name. They call it the Danimal. And so, you know, that's because I told them my favorite candy was a Take 5 bar. So they basically decomposed the Take 5 bar, added a shot of espresso and turned it into a milkshake. So I have to say that's my go-to order is the Danimal milkshake and the sausage cauliflower crust pizza.
All right. Shout out to the Sizzle and Bandit guys out there. If people want to either A, work for you, B, sell their goods on your platform, or C, just get started, you know, in their city, tell us how they can get involved here.
Listen, I'm going to open it up. Shoot me an email directly, df@gopuff.com. I answer my email multiple times a day. So any questions or inquiries or, you know, if you want to join Team Blue, feel free to shoot me an email and we'll take it from there.
Awesome. Well, really looking forward to seeing how the rest of the year plays out for you guys. And thank you so much for taking the time out today to chat with everyone.
Matt, thanks so much for having me and for the continued concentration and coverage on our space.
All right, man. Take care. I'll talk to you soon.
I'll see you later.
Thanks for tuning in. If you like what you hear, please hit subscribe wherever you're listening to this podcast. And if you're curious to get a firsthand look at the cutting edge of food and tech, check out hungry.tv. That's Hungry with No You, where you can join in on live conversations like these or sign up for the free weekly newsletter.